What I resent is the attempt at defamation of character and the attempt to make my children ashamed that they were born. If there's a mongrel in the crowd, it's me, because I'm Irish and one-quarter Cherokee Indian. I've no interest in politics. My business is making music, and I've sung John Henry as well as Remember the Alamo. If I win this, I'm going to give the money to the defense budget. It became very serious for all of us in the cash camp, says Saul Holliff. Not only serious, but threatening. Columbia's top brass finally came to help us, and we threatened a major lawsuit when it became obvious that the Klan had made an egregious error in Vivian's background. So we had them cold. When they saw the mistake that they had made, they backed away, apologized, and stopped everything. Eventually, after making another serious mistake, they were sued and went bankrupt. In October 1965, 3 weeks after the El Paso arrest, Cash's friend Peter LaFarge, only 34 years old, was found dead in his New York apartment. Though he officially died of a stroke, the drug paraphernalia found in the room suggested an overdose, either deliberate or accidental. Initially, this succession of events sobered Johnny right up. He stopped taking pills, began to gain some weight, and started recording a lighthearted album that used several songs written by his old friend Jack Clement. Everybody Loves a Nut appeared to be a deliberate diversion from all the morbidity around him. In the first session after his court appearance, Cash recorded The Frozen Logger, the bug that tried to crawl around the world, Flushed from the Bathroom of Your Heart, Dirty Old Egg-Sucking Dog, and Take Me Home. I'd always written novelty songs, and he just decided he wanted to cut a novelty album, says Clement. I was all for it because I happened to have a bunch of material in that direction. Cash didn't stay clean for long. Soon after starting a new tour, he was back on the pills. In May 1966, he arrived in London to tour England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. From there, he planned to go on to play in Europe. Bob Dylan's tour coincided with Cash's. They had many of the same cities scheduled, though on different dates. Since their last meeting in the summer of 1964, Dylan had grown his hair into an afro, hired a band, the Hawks, to play behind him, and forsaken his political protests for surreal explorations of different states of consciousness. While this broadened his fan base and put him on equal footing with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, it alienated some of his early supporters who believed he had betrayed the folk movement. They viewed Dylan's electrified music and mod shirts and boots as a capitulation to modern pop. At a concert in Manchester, a member of the audience famously shouted out, "Judas!" when the set changed from acoustic to electric. Although Dylan had a naturally fertile imagination, some of the perceptions and illusions in the new songs obviously came from drug experiences. Dylan took pills to keep up the pace, smoked pot to relax, and possibly dropped LSD to explore. He never directly answered when asked exactly what he took, but he did say, "I wouldn't advise anybody to use drugs, certainly not the hard drugs. Drugs are medicine, but opium and hash and pot, now those things aren't drugs. They just bend your mind a little. I think everybody's mind should be bent once in a while." The two men met up at Dylan's hotel in Mayfair, a meeting captured by director D.A. Pennybaker and used in The Document, his unreleased film of the 1966 tour. The sequence shows Dylan playing "I Still Miss Someone" on an upright piano while Cash, dressed in a dark jacket and an open-necked shirt, stands beside him harmonizing. At the end, a smiling Cash tells Dylan, "You know, the tune's completely different." He then sings it to him as it should have been. On May 11th, one of Cash's days off, he traveled to Cardiff to see Dylan. Holliff managed to book Cash a show at the Olympia Theater in Paris immediately following the British tour. The prestigious engagement had taken a lot of negotiating, but when the manager arrived at Heathrow Airport to fly on to Paris, Cash didn't turn up. He had apparently partied so hard with Dylan that he just couldn't make it. "That's when I resigned," says Holliff. "I spent the next week just walking around Hyde Park contemplating my future before buying myself a first-class ticket back home." The break between Holliff and Cash lasted for 6 weeks. When Cash returned to the States, he made a brief appearance at Casita Springs but left almost immediately on June 2, 1966, to tour. He didn't even come back at the end of the tour. Instead, he stayed with Gene Ferguson in Brentwood, but no one else knew where he was. "Vivian would call me to see if John was there," says Ferguson. "Then June would call me to see if John was there. I hate to admit it, but I lied to both of them. He put me in a real precarious position." This desertion was the final straw for Vivian. She hired an attorney, Lawrence Storch, and on June 30th filed for divorce on the grounds that, since the marriage of the parties, defendant has treated plaintiff with extreme cruelty and has wrongfully inflicted upon her grievous mental suffering and anguish. She was particularly concerned about her share of the estate because she was without sufficient funds or means with which to support herself and said minor children. She claimed she had reason to believe that unless restrained by a court order, Cash would try to sell, dispose of, or encumber said community property for the purpose of defeating plaintiff's rights and claims. To prevent him from selling the property or concealing his earnings, a court order was issued, and because she had no idea where Cash was living, she had it published in the Nashville Banner 4 times during August 1966. It ordered John R. Cash to appear and show cause before the above-titled court, the Superior Court of the State of California, in the courtroom of said court at the courthouse in the City of Ventura, County of Ventura, State of California, on the 22nd day of August 1966 at the hour of 9 a.m. of said day, or as soon as counsel can be heard, who this court should not make the said orders. The orders included custody and control of the children, support and maintenance during the action, attorney's fees, and restraint on disposing his property during the action. Cash failed to appear in court on August 22nd. On August 29th, his attorney, Bruce Thompson, responded to the complaint for divorce. He assured the court that Cash was neither guilty of extreme cruelty nor of causing grievous mental suffering and anguish. He further denied that Cash intended to conceal his wealth or dispose of property and that Vivian was without sufficient funds. In October, Cash agreed that she should have custody of the children pending a trial and promised not to sell any property. Vivian agreed to withdraw her claim for maintenance during the same period. "I was 11 years old at the time," says Roseanne. "There was none of this, 'Hey, let's sit down and talk about this.' I think my mother was freaked out and she was of an age where you just didn't talk about these things, particularly with the children. So we were left full of anxiety and wondering what was wrong. I remember seeing it in a newspaper. It said that my mother was suing my father on the grounds of mental cruelty. I was at my grandmother's house, and she saw me reading this and said to me, 'Your daddy is not cruel.' I was so grateful to her for saying that. When Kathy asked her mother what it would mean if there was a divorce, Vivian told her that she shouldn't worry too much, because the only difference would be that daddy's clothes would no longer be hanging in the closet." Cash moved out of Ferguson's home and rented a one-bedroom, first-floor apartment at the Fontaine Royale Apartments off Gallatin Road in Madison, Tennessee. Close to Mother Maybelle and Pop Carter's home on Coode Lane, his new place was also near June's home on Gibson Drive, although he made a point of not being seen there. In August, he ran into Waylon Jennings looking for a new place, and the two soon became roommates. It was a cramped and disorderly bachelor pad. 2 king-sized beds filled the bedroom. Dirty plates littered the kitchen, and each man hid his drugs in different secret places, thinking that the other wasn't aware of his habit. The only thing that made the arrangement bearable was that, for the most part, their tour schedules kept them from sleeping in the apartment at the same time, and once a week, June and Maybelle would come by to tidy and clean. It made no sense for someone of his fame and wealth to live in such modest circumstances permanently. With his divorce all but signed, Cash wanted to buy a home where he could relax and write, where he could entertain and showcase his expanding collection of books and records. He contacted Braxton Dixon, a local builder, and asked to see available lots. At the time, Dixon was building a unique house overlooking Old Hickory Lake in Hendersonville, about 20 miles north of Nashville. He decided to show Cash the property, almost as an afterthought, because he knew Cash wanted something similar that was close to water. Dixon didn't think of it as a spec house, but as one he might live in himself. The house was built from stone and wood Dixon had collected from old barns and houses, some of them more than 200 years old. The rafters were made of skinned tree trunks, and 3 of the outside walls were of glass. It was unusual and impressive, and Cash fell in love with it on the spot. He loved the lake and the roughness of the stones and wood. It filled him with a sense of peace and space. He imagined it as a place where he could straighten himself out and get reacquainted with the trees, flowers, grass, and earth that had inspired him as a boy. Dixon tried to tell him it wasn't for sale. "Everything's for sale," Cash answered, and he negotiated a deal. Moving in, even before it was completed, he became close friends with Dixon, who quickly learned about Cash's drug problem. He genuinely wanted the new house to signify a new start and desperately wanted to kick his habit because June refused to marry him until he went straight. "He called us one day and said he wanted us to come over and see his new house," says Don Reed of the Statler Brothers. "So we did. There wasn't a stick of furniture in it, and I don't think there was even any electricity. He had asked us to bring a guitar. So the four of us went out, and he was there with June, and he said, "I want you to christen my house." I remember it was dusk, and there were no lights. We stood in the living room, and we sang "How Great Thou Art." He wanted that to be the first song ever sung in his house.